Chatter on books. It's Cliff Notes for book clubs. Why read the book if you can listen to Chatter on Books? I'm Jamie McIntyre, your announcer, but you don't care about that. Here again is your host, Tori Clark.
Welcome back to Chatter on Books. I hope you're doing well. Hope you're staying healthy. I'm wearing my mask 24/7. I don't know about anybody else, but only because I'm in a room alone do I not have my mask on. And in just a little bit, we are going to be talking with Carrie Mayer, who is the author of The Paris Bookseller. It's a beautiful cover, by the way, and I'm going to ask Carrie about this and about the wonderful dog on the cover, which is a really remarkable story. And the timing of this could not be more wonderful because it is about Sylvia Beach, who created Shakespeare and Company, American woman in Paris, English speaking, creates this incredible bookstore and is the first incredibly brave person who publishes Ulysses, which had an incredible impact on the rest of the literary world. It's a fabulous book, and I have so many questions that I'll never get to all of them. But in the meantime, we've got Claude, award-winning Claude Jennings, doing all the important work. We have David Aldridge. David, I have to talk briefly about this weekend. And we have Jamie McIntyre, deep from the throes of rehab. Okay, Jamie, first, very quick, CNN headlines, 0 to 10. How's the rehab going?
The hand's doing good. It's been 3 months. And next step is some laser surgery. I have a glove on, so you can't see. Laser surgery to get my fingers back to moving again. This, in case anybody is tuning in for the first show, is because I burned my hand in a kitchen fire 3 months ago.
Jamie, let's be honest. You burned your hand in a severe popcorn-related hand injury.
Never got to the popcorn. It was just oil.
Have you used your air popper yet that Roberta got for you?
Yes. Works great. Okay. It makes twice as much popcorn, too.
Excellent. Okay, David, pretty good games yesterday. Not like the previous weekend.
Yes, they were both excellent. Yes, they were both excellent games. Excellent. Down to the wire finishes.
Fourth quarter, minute and a half, 2 minutes. Either game could have gone both ways, right?
Yeah, could have. I mean, I kind of thought once Kansas City didn't win in regulation, they probably weren't going to win in overtime just because Cincinnati had all the momentum and it turned out that way.
But they won the coin toss, and we all know whoever wins the coin toss wins the game.
Man, that's a close-up of the coin.
That's right. So we've heard, right, Jamie?
Okay. Will that blunt any of the disgruntlement about changing the overtime rules in the playoffs?
I hope so. It's so stupid. It's like Jimmy Johnson was the coach of the Cowboys for many years and won a couple Super Bowls for them. But before then, he was the head coach at the University of Miami, and they became notorious for kind of running up the score against hapless opponents. And one time someone came to him at the end of a game and said, "Why did you keep doing what you were doing? You're up 61-7. And he said, he said, "I can't help it if you have a bad team." That's exactly right. Like, if you don't want them to score in overtime, stop them. You're allowed to stop them. It's not like you're not allowed to tackle or blitz or play defense. Stop them if you don't want them to score.
The college football overtime rules are different. Yes. And I know that because I watched a University of Florida game earlier in the season that I think went into five overtimes. It just never ended because they just kept matching each other with either field.
And that's stupid. And that should not be how you decide a football game. It's like deciding a soccer match on penalty kicks, which is just absurd.
Exactly.
So, you would never do it. So, no, I'm not. I don't think they should change the rules. I think teams should stop whining and play better defense.
Nice. Get the ball back. Nice.
Like Cincinnati did, for example. Now they're going to the Super Bowl.
Okay, last football question. Tom Brady, retiring or not retiring? If so, when?
I mean, I think he's retiring. Tom is very anal and very controlling and wants to announce this himself on his own platform. He's got this website, TB12, that he does all this stuff on. And he has relationships with people in media that I'm sure he promised them that they would get the exclusive.
Yeah.
So someone jumped the gun. It doesn't mean they were wrong. It just means they jumped the gun. And that's, do you remember the story that Ben Bradley used to tell all the time about LBJ and how he found out that Kennedy was going to toss LBJ aside in 64 and put somebody else on his VP. And he wrote it, and it was premature. And then the next day, I'm totally messing up this story. It was not LBJ. It was J. Edgar Hoover.
Hoover, right.
And J. Edgar Hoover was thought to be on the outs as head of the FBI. And the next day, after the story came out, the president appointed J. Edgar Hoover director of the FBI for life. And they say, oh, you screwed up, Bradley. You gave us J. Edgar Hoover forever. And he said, well, I did screw up, but I wasn't wrong. And that's what I think these reporters who have reported this aren't wrong. They just jumped the gun.
So if I take what you're saying that now that somebody jumped the gun, Brady's going to play for life. Is that am I getting the right read on that? I think that's what you're saying.
One of my epically tragic jobs, somebody, a really well-known journalist, called me up once and said, hey, and it was like late at night, and this when we had real phones, calls me at home, goes, hey, I hear you're resigning. It's like, oh, I hope you're right. I didn't know, but I hope you're right. Because in Washington, you're always given the opportunity to resign for personal reasons, which when men say it, it's bullshit. When women say it, it's absolutely true. Absolutely true. Okay, Claude, I should have done this at the top of the show. Put on your best salesman's hat and tell our Patreon patrons what a wonderful time they're having and how everyone else should become a Patreon patron because they get special stuff.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Bonus content. Before the show and after this show, there's all kinds of, chatter, pun intended, between hosts and guests and stuff. And you get all that bonus content. There's a section or a segment at the end of the show called 60 Seconds More. You get to hear that as well, only if you're a Patreon member. And then me and all the patrons like Shelly and Patty, Kevin and those guys, we're discussing how to start the Chatter on Books Patreon book club. And also you get to view the show live virtually through the magic of Zoom. So go to patreon.com, search Chatter on Books, sign up today, and you get all that bonus content and all the other
excellent. It's that award-winning voice, it just is. By the way, I got an email from somebody on our Somerset listserv today that Chatter the restaurant, and right now Carrie's watching the show going, what the F?
I'm keeping up barely.
Yasmin Hassan, who has helped make this happen with Carrie tonight, is going, oh, I'm going to kill myself. Chatter the Restaurant, formerly owned by Tony Kornheiser and friends, Carrie, was the original place where Chatter on Books started. Because Claude and I had this brilliant idea that Tony Kornheiser should not just have his own podcast. He should take the restaurant and have Chatter on Books, Chatter on Law, Chatter on Politics, you name it, right? Just classic whatever. Yeah. And so for the first year, maybe we did Chatter on Books in the restaurant.
Yes.
And then the restaurant had an epically tragic closing. And so we moved to my dining room for a while. And then the pandemic hit. But the location, the corner of Wisconsin and Jennifer, is being turned into a new... All I've heard is it's a new restaurant / dance place.
I heard Mediterranean sports bar.
I heard Mediterranean-themed food and dancing at night.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. I thought I heard sports bar, but okay. Lord knows we don't need another sports bar, so Mediterranean place.
I always thought the demise of the restaurant was linked to my proposal for the Chatter on Mimes. This never took off.
All right, I have one review and one email, and then we have a pop quiz. So this Apple review, and thanks for all those people, go to Apple iTunes and write the reviews on top of the one that called David and me a racist.
Exactly. Never specifying which race we hated.
Did you see the tweet, David, that I didn't understand and had to be explained to me?
Which one?
You've said many times, would somebody please explain what races do you and I not like?
Exactly. Just tell me which one.
Somebody tweeted out very funny. David doesn't like the 400 meters. Tori hates the 1500.
Exactly so.
That's 400
brutal.
That had to be explained to me, and then I laughed. Okay, so Claire BVH put on Apple iTunes, what a wonderful way to find new books. Thank you. Makes my day. And I have heard from so many people. Because of the show, they find authors, they find books they would never have picked up otherwise because they tragically read nothing but the New York Times Book Review. And my new friend Mark emailed me yesterday, and he said he emailed me about something else. But he wrote, as an aside, I recently discovered the podcast and have really enjoyed it, especially the episode with Steve Roberts. Certainly will get a copy of his book. Steve Roberts, who wrote the wonderful book, about Cokie, A Life Well Lived. Tremendous response to that.
Yeah, absolutely. That was something. That was a good show.
It was a good show. It was like 95 minutes long, right?
No, it wasn't that long.
It was long because he was telling great stories.
I mean, it was long, but it wasn't an hour and a half. No, it was like 70, 75.
One of the parts that I love so much about this, that episode was, and Steve, was it's, and Jamie probably knows this, David and Clyde maybe a little bit less so because you weren't as involved in politics. But if it was the 80s, the 90s, when the two of them were first really getting going, Steve was the rock star, right? He was a New York Times political correspondent.
Sure.
Everybody knew who he was. Everybody wanted to invite him to lunch, those kinds of things. And Cokie was this really nice person. And then it shifted. Late 90s, 2000s, it shifted.
Sure.
And he was so honest about how it was hard on their marriage, but they, you know, they continued and thrived and had one of the greatest marriages of all time. But very honest. I love that. Okay, David and Jamie, are you ready for your pop quiz?
Always.
There's a really good one coming up.
I wish you just, you know, on these talk shows and quiz shows, they always give the, you know, the guests hints about what it's going to be about so they can think of clever things ahead of time. So just for the record, we have no idea.
No idea.
The slightest idea what you're going to say next.
Okay. Oh, if I said it was a pop quiz on fill in the blank, red Labradors from West Virginia, you would Google red Labradors
exactly.
from West Virginia, and then you would know everything.
Yes,
so no.
And then we wouldn't have that big, long pause that Claude has to edit out.
Which he does so well. Okay, I'm going to give you four cities. So back in the day, before the pandemic, I used to travel a lot. And one of my favorite things to do was to go into a, you know, airport bookstore or go into a bookstore in any town and figure out what are the best sellers in this town and compare it to other cities. And I just loved that. You know, was Moby Dick selling well anywhere? No, it was not. I'm going to give you four cities. I should have done uneven numbers, but I'm going to give you four cities and four books.
All right.
And you're going to have to guess which book is the bestseller in which city. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. So the four cities, alphabetic order, Boston, Chicago, Seattle, Tulsa.
Okay.
Kind of geographically, whatever. Okay. The four books, The Sentence by Louise Harper, The Lincoln Highway, Cloud Cuckoo Land, and Bedrock Faith. And if you don't know any of those, I can explain a little bit to help you as you figure this out.
The Cuckoo one I'm not familiar with.
Cloud Cuckoo Land, Anthony Doerr, you know, All the Light We Shine. Supposed to be spectacular. I wanted it to be spectacular. I didn't love it, but it's doing well.
Mm. I would just say that if this was a team competition, you wouldn't want me on your team.
Yeah, you'd be asked last. Was that like dodgeball? Were you?
I know
last,
David
Jamie?
Knows. I know he knows these right off the top of his head. So
sure, of course, yeah.
You should go first.
Okay, we'll do. Okay, so The Sentence, really interesting about independent bookstore, kind of a ghost kind of situation.
Uh-huh.
The Lincoln Highway, great guys on the road, wonderful. Cloud Cuckoo Land. Bedrock Faith is about a neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
So let's pick Seattle first.
All right, Seattle, I will go with the...
I have to keep track of the score.
Not the neighborhood book and not the cuckoo book. What were the other two?
Lincoln Highway and The Sentence.
The Sentence for Seattle.
You would be wrong. Jamie, do you have a guess?
I was going to go with the, as Dave so artfully put it, the cuckoo book.
There you go.
Here's the thing. If you can't remember the names of the books, you're already at a big disadvantage.
Sure.
Yeah. So Claude, help me keep score. Jamie won.
Jamie's up 1-0. 1-0 okay. Since we're on the soccer theme.
There we go.
I'd just like to point out that my chances went up right away when you, like Monty Hall, revealed what was behind one of the doors was not the prize.
There we go. Okay, Chicago.
Chicago, I'm going to go with the neighborhood book.
Jamie?
I'm going to go with David on this one.
Okay, you each get 1 point.
Boom.
Well, I think that means...
It's 2-1.
2-1. Mm-hmm.
2-1.
Okay, all right. Okay, Tulsa.
Tulsa, the travel road book.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, too. I'm not just parody. I was just... That was what... I thought you were going to ask me first because it's not fair... to make David go first all the time, but that's my choice too.
Okay, the Lincoln Highway. You're both correct.
Okay.
So this is process of elimination.
Yeah, by
process. Do you remember what the last one was? That's why I shouldn't have done even numbers.
Cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs, whatever.
Oh, Bedrock Faith.
I already picked that one.
Bedrock Faith. Okay, so Claude, I think Jamie won.
Yeah, 3-2.
Okay.
And what did I win, by the way?
Nothing. Absolutely nothing. The opportunity to come back again.
All right. She's about to bolt, so we better get her on the show.
And the chance of how to learn how to play the piano with your feet, Jamie, which is an inside joke.
I just remember that when the Joy Boys, remember the Joy Boys?
Sure.
Yes.
WRC, they would have a contest. They would always say, in the case of duplicate prizes, ties will be awarded. So I'm hoping to get a tie out of this.
Did you guys watch Amy Schneider on Jeopardy?
I did.
Stunning.
Yeah, she's great.
She's
great.
Crushed. And never wasted a second. Never.
No, and that was kind of, who wrote the story about the kind of how it's not as much, well, it is obviously about being smart if that's it, but it's more about being able to buzz in quicker than anybody else. And there's certain people that just have a knack for getting that button pressed down. She was, her hand eye coordination must be fantastic because she.
So I did not see it, but my wife, the lovely and talented Roberta, was telling me about it. And she asked me the final Jeopardy question that, she didn't get, which was...
I was stunned by this.
What's the only country in the world that ends with an H?
Yeah.
And I got thought about that for, I don't know, 20 minutes before I could come up with it. So I definitely would not have been able
It's so weird. It came to me in about 4 seconds.
Really?
And that doesn't mean I'm smart. It just means that particular... It
means you should be on Jeopardy.
And David, the answer was?
Bangladesh.
Thank you. Jamie, you've probably been there.
No, I haven't.
No.
I've been to 65 countries in the world, but not Bangladesh.
That's pretty good.
I mean, it was just kind of a process of elimination because if it ends in an H, that means there's probably a consonant next to it.
Yeah.
There's a vowel next to
the process of elimination. I went through about 184 countries.
So it was like, okay, it's A-T-H or, and it was just
yeah.
Yeah,
I kept getting stuck up on Banda Aceh, which I had been to once, but that's not a country. It's this area of Indonesia. So once I get the wrong answer in my head,
Gary is literally getting in a cab to go to the airport now.
Enough about my feelings.
This is fascinating, actually. I was sitting there thinking, how is that possible that the only country in the world that ends with an H is only one? How is that really?
Yeah, and I think Amy wanted to be done. I think it was never about the money. Amy just said, I've had enough of this.
I think
I want to be done.
I think that
he did say in an interview that she was actually upset about losing. She didn't want to. People said, oh, she probably wanted to, you know, like Cal Ripken, get the streak over with. But no, she said she really did want to win and was really, disappointed that she didn't.
Okay.
But
all right, we have one last question for, and Claude, you have to answer too. And then we'll go to Carrie, I promise. Permanent host of Jeopardy. Ken Jennings, the woman from Big Bang Theory.
Mia, what's her name?
She's a neuroscientist.
Mia Bialik.
Thank you.
The actress who's an actual neurosurgeon or neuroscientist. Mm-hmm. Yes.
As she constantly reminds us on that infomercial for a tragically corrupt.
She's really smart. It's okay to be, to tell people you're smart.
Was she also like Punky Brewster?
She was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm okay with Punky Brewster. I'm not okay with peddling malpractice like supplements. Claude, who do you want? Ken Jennings or?
I'm assuming that Aaron Rodgers is now eliminated.
Yeah, I was just saying, anybody but Aaron Rodgers.
ABA.
No, I'm good with the actress from Big Bang Theory. I like her. She's good.
That's her.
She was on Blossom. Thank you, Patty.
Bialik, I think it's
Blossom.
That is. Yeah.
Right? Yeah, Patty just chimed in from Cutter. She was Blossom. Okay, all right.
I don't really care.
It's 6:20. It's 6:21.
They will both be fine. Either one will be fine.
Be fine. Ken Jennings oozes Jeopardy.
I like Ken Jennings. I don't dislike Mayim Bialik, though. I mean, so I don't have a dog in this hunt, okay?
Ken Jennings dresses better. I'm just saying. Okay, now we're a minute late for Carrie Maron. We have to go to her and this fabulous book, The Paris Bookseller. Carrie, there's a mathematical thing. The number of times we mention the name of the book, The Paris Bookseller, determines how many times it sells. So we're going to name it many, many times.
Okay.
It is fabulous. And I'm going to kind of preempt Jamie McIntyre, who usually asks the most important question, but I won't. But you have tackled in your writing a Kennedy, Grace Kelly, and then you decided Sylvia Beach, who's just an incredible figure in literature. What caused you to go that direction?
Well, so there is actually a sort of an accidental through line with all three of those women, which is that they're American women who found themselves in Europe and did remarkable things in Europe. Mm-hmm. And so in the case of Sylvia Beach, you know, in 1919, she opens the original Shakespeare and Company bookstore in Paris. And I came to know her story as an undergraduate in college. I was obsessed with the 1920s. I read everything I could, especially entranced by this, you know, the expats of the 20s who lived in Paris during that decade. And I found her memoir, you know, those great bargain book bins in front of college bookstores. I found her memoir in one of those bins and I brought it home and I read it and I just was enthralled by her story. And, you know, the fact that she was friends with Ernest Hemingway and James Joyce, and she published Ulysses when it became a banned book. But, you know, I was 20 years old. I kind of filed it away under good to know. And fast forward more than two decades, and here we are with The Paris Bookseller.
Yeah. You're one of the few people we've had on the show who actually knew as a young person that they wanted to be a writer. Is that correct?
I wrote my first unfinished novel in fifth grade.
Okay, two questions. What was it about, and will you finish it?
No, I will never finish it, because I will. Partly because I will never find the yellow legal pad I borrowed from my dad to write it longhand. And it was about a girl, and who befriends another girl who is blind. And I do not wow. ask me where I came up with that, but that was what it was about.
Wow. Okay, and what did you learn along the way as you wanted to become a writer about eavesdropping and soap operas? Because I've learned that they were important to your literary development.
Yeah, so before I signed a book deal for a novel, I wrote a writing memoir sort of in the vein of Bird by Bird by Annie Lamott. And my mm-hmm. book is called This Is Not a Writing Manual. And indeed, I talk about drawing inspiration from soap operas and romance novels and other unlikely, you know, people think unlikely sources. The soap opera one is great. I mean, my mom and I grew up watching Another World, which was a soap opera, I think on uh-huh. NBC with my mom. And not only did, you know, the arc of all the stories in the soap opera just totally suck me in and sort of teach me lessons about how to craft a story. There was, as one of the main characters, long-term characters, a character named Felicia Gallant, who wrote romance novels and like with a feather boa on. And, you know, she was just fabulous. And, you know, her best friend was Cass Winthrop, who was like this total playboy, but the two of them never got involved. Anyway, it was just great. And so how could I not want to be a writer?
Somewhere in that beautiful space behind you, is there a feather boa hiding in a closet?
You know, no, but like there should be.
Yeah, there absolutely should be. Jamie or David, did you guys ever watch soap operas when you were younger?
I just told somebody this last week and I don't know why. Oh, I actually didn't know why, but it's not worth repeating here. Yes.
Might be, David.
Well, I saw a look of recognition on your face when I said Another World. You were like nodding your head.
No, because I was a latchkey kid. And so when I came home from school, I had to entertain myself. And so you could either watch the Flintstones rerun for the 5,000th time. I got into General Hospital when Luke and Laura got married. Got together. But I stopped. I didn't watch that for very long. I just watched that particular arc. And when it ended, I stopped watching. But I got totally into The Edge of Night. I don't know why. Well, I do know why, because it came on at 4 o'clock, which is when I got home from school. And I just watched The Edge of Night every day. This went on for 3 years.
Wow.
So when I was in high school.
David, I've known you for a long time. This never would have occurred to me.
Oh, yeah.
What like Carrie, what did you learn from it? How did it contribute to your current?
It would not. It contributed in no way to my current job. It was just something to do when I was bored before I got into doing my homework. And it just, you just get into the, like Carrie said, you get into the arc, you get into the storylines and, wow, oh, what's going to happen to, what was her name? Raven, poor Raven, you know, like, are always named after birds or exotic ports of call. And so.
So Tori.
Yes, sir.
Tori, I was going to say.
This is just, I'm sorry, I'm kind of stunned. This just opens up a whole new chapter to David Alders that never occurred to me before.
Oh, sure.
So Tori, I was going to say, I never watched soap operas, but I have to say.
Me either.
Well, so two things. One, if I did, I probably would have watched Dark Shadows. I heard a lot of people who watch that are, you know, like fans for life and go to conventions and all kinds of things. But I started to say no, but then, you know, really so much of the episodic series of streaming television these days are really just, you know, highbrow soap operas. And whether it's you're watching Downton Abbey or The Sopranos, it's the same thing. You're tuning in to find out what happened to the characters. You're sucked into the story arc and it meanders all over the place, especially these series that go on for, you know, 8 or 9 or 10 seasons or something. I'm watching the fourth season of Ozark now just because it's the latest soap opera I'm watching. So the answer is yes, I do watch soap operas.
That is 100% true.
Yeah, that is absolutely true. Okay, Carrie, let's continue to talk about The Paris Bookseller, which is about Sylvia Beach, who is an incredible person. It is also about these literary giants. And the more I read it, and I read the book, and I listened to the book, and whoever did the reading of the book did a fantastic job.
Right? Lauren Ullman. She's amazing. Lauren Ullman.
She's amazing. We should have her on the show one time. but I thought to myself, wow, this person, Carrie Mayer, is either the best read person we've ever encountered, the most audacious person we've ever encountered, or the stupidest person we've ever encountered. Because you, in the course of this book, and I'm not giving anything away by saying this, but Sylvia comes in contact with all these incredible people, with James Joyce, with Ezra Pound, with Ernest Hemingway. And it was for real. And this, reading this book, everybody, I had one hand on the book or in my car and one hand on the Google machine, which only at the red lights. And I'd hear something in the book, or I'd read something in the book, and I'd go, oh, wait a minute, that can't be. And I'd look it up and go, no, my God, that was for real. Sylvia really did interact with that incredible author on these kinds of things. But what gave you the confidence to write this story?
That is a great question. And I hope that I don't think I'm any of those three things. but I will tell you, I will say this. I think part of what gave me the confidence was my two previous novels. Mm-hmm. I sort of like to say that, like, so even though I've been carrying Sylvia's story around with me my entire adult life, I'm very glad that I wrote, that it didn't occur to me to write about her sooner. Because I think that if my first try at historical fiction had involved trying to put dialogue words in the mouth of Ernest Hemingway and James Joyce, I would have just thrown in the towel. Uh-huh. So I had to practice with John F. Kennedy first because he's an important character in the Kennedy Debutante, which is about his younger sister, Kik Kennedy. So JFK was a character, Joe Sr., Rose Kennedy, all those famous Kennedys were characters. And that was probably my biggest stumbling block in writing historical fiction. I was just like, you know, who am I to be writing about the Kennedys? Like, you know, but I just had to, as a two really good writer friends of mine from very different parts of my life who didn't even know each other said the same thing to me in a short period of time. They said, but Carrie, it's your book, isn't it? And I've really carried that around with me through all three of these novels of historical fiction, because you have to kind of embrace the reality that it is a novel and it is your novel. And so your characters are your interpretations of those people, you know. So my Sylvia Beach, my James Joyce, my Ernest Hemingway and Ezra Pound would be different from any other writer's version. That's just something that I've come to really like about the genre.
Okay. But are you incredibly well read? Did you read all of James Joyce? Have you read all of
I cannot with any honesty say I've read all of James Joyce. No. Okay. I've read some by all the writers that appear in the book. And I've read more by others, some than others. And in fact, I've probably read the most by F. Scott Fitzgerald, who only appears kind of off scene.
Briefly.
Yeah, he's just like in the background. But I couldn't weave him in well enough. But I've certainly read, one of my favorite books of all time is Ernest Hemingway's A Movable Feast, the memoir he writes later in his life, reflecting on being a young man in Paris during this decade, in which he says of Sylvia, "No one I ever knew was nicer to me." Which was just so telling. I at least try to read something if I hadn't read anything before. Probably the character I'd read the least from was Ezra Pound. And so I had to sort of go looking for some of his poems and some of his essays to make sure I kind of had him in my head the right way.
Well, one of the obsessive things I did is, there are so many wonderful conversations between and among Sylvia and these great writers. And it's just wonderful. And sometimes they'd be talking about the criticism of some of their pieces of work. And I go, well, I wonder how dead on that is. And so I my Google machine at a very long red light, go, oh my God, that was dead on. Okay. But a lot of this, I'm still just amazed at your courage in tackling this and the way you tackled it so spectacularly. David first and then Jamie, both of you incredibly well-known, incredibly well-respected in your fields and beyond. Ever intimidated by anybody you covered? David first and then Jamie.
That's a great question.
If David ever meets Dolly Parton, by the way, Carrie, he's just going to be a puddle. We're going to make it happen.
I love Dolly Parton.
I would be too.
I would love to meet Dolly Parton. I wouldn't be intimidated by her. I don't think I would be.
You would be. You're going to melt.
Well, no, there's certain women that I would melt for. Well, she'd be close.
Shocking on, baby.
Yeah. All right. No, Arthur Ashe was the one person that I was just like humming a humming a humming a humming a humming a humming.
When did you meet him and why? I understand why, but when did you meet him? What were the circumstances?
Well, once on the phone and once in person. when I first started at the Post, it was general assignment, which means you cover whatever needs covering at the moment. And at that time, as is the case now, there was this great kind of Suris in the tennis community, in the American tennis community, about the lack of great American male tennis players. And where are the great American male tennis players? We write the story every 5 or 6 years at the Washington Post or in other places. So it was my turn. So my editor, I was like,
well, he's a new kid. Send him out.
He's a new kid. Who should I call? And there's a couple of people, I had gotten a couple of people on the phone, but it wasn't really coming together. And I'm not sure. And my editor, Lenny Shapiro, said, well, call Arthur at home. And I was like, Arthur who? It was like Arthur Ashe. I said, I'm sorry, Lynn, I don't quite have Arthur's home number handy. And he did. He gave it to me and called my bluff. And I had to call Arthur Ashe at home.
Wow.
And he couldn't have been more gracious about it, receiving this cold call from this 22-year-old punk kid reporter, didn't know anything. Ugh. Anything. And it was just, but you know, I was just like, duh, 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 duh. I didn't know what I was doing. It was terrible.
Wow. Okay. That's a great one. Jamie, anybody fearsome woman who used to work at the Pentagon, and you're like, I couldn't even.
So one of the great things about being a journalist and being a reporter is you don't work for any of these people that you cover. And so I found it really easy to not be intimidated by, no matter how high the government official was or how many stars a general had on their shoulder when I covered the Pentagon. I think the one fear I might have had was revealing my ignorance in some, vast area of world affairs that I should be aware of.
Like a country that ends with the letter H?
Yeah, discovered also that if you ask simple questions that don't have a premise that can then be a reveal that you don't actually know what you're talking about, you can pretty much fake that and learn a lot in the process. So not really intimidated, but sometimes very cautious about revealing my, gaps in my knowledge. And I would just point out, I think we all have gaps in our knowledge. You just don't want them to become obvious when you're dealing with somebody of importance.
But that's what you say up front. I have no idea what I'm talking about here, but why don't you tell me? And then the person just spills his or her guts.
That's right. It works with some people.
Doesn't work with everybody. That's right, Jamie. Doesn't work with everybody. But sometimes people do take pity on you.
Okay. All right. Back to Carrie and the Paris bookseller, which is fabulous. And can, commercial break. Carrie, the cover is fabulous. Can you tell us about that? Can you see it?
So are people able to see me?
Yes. They're able to see you.
Yeah. All right. So you're holding up the cover.
And
so
it's behind
this
you.
Behind me is the painting.
Wow.
By an artist, a painter, a fine art painter named Terry Mura, who lives in Los Angeles. You can follow him on Instagram and find his work in galleries. Who Berkeley, my wonderful publisher, commissioned this painting.
Wow.
To become the cover. Now, I mean, other books. So, and this is not that unusual, but you know, like this is The Girl in White Gloves, which is about Grace Kelly, which is, you know, like many book covers is a beautiful sort of compilation of like stock images and like cut, like they did beautiful things with the cover and everything. But sometimes they do ask artists to create original works of art. And in this case they did. So what happened was in order to kind of get the frame right, so to speak, and like the characters and like how much of the book story we were going to see, there were several iterations of sketches that kind of went back and forth between me and the publisher and the artist to figure it out. And you mentioned the dog. So little Teddy, the shop dog, who I don't know if you can see, there's a bit of a glare on the painting. Yeah, I apologize.
You can see him.
But he is really was Sylvia Beach's shop dog, and he plays an important role in one of the scenes in the book. She also had a cat, but we weren't going to put also the dog and the cat. But she had a cat named Lucky. I asked to have Teddy on the cover, and I'm very glad I did, because look at him looking out from, you know,
Teddy, without giving too much away, appropriately hates one of the most hateful people in the story of Sylvia Beach and the publishing of Ulysses. So he was absolutely spectacular. So again, I was hitting the Google machine constantly. There must have been tons of research. And one of the things is there, if you could pick anybody in this book, Sylvia Beach, the store, Ernest Hemingway, James Joyce, Ezra Pound, it goes on, and George Bernard Shaw. There's been a mountain written about these people. So how did you, I know you did a ton of research, but tell us about doing the research and how did you keep yourself from being overwhelmed by it and allowing it to influence your writing too much?
You know, that's a great question. And so there's a couple of versions of the answer. One is, you know, because I was, as I said earlier, like an undergraduate obsessed with this time period, I was able to bring like a lifetime of reading to the writing of this book. Did I go back and reread everything that I had read from this time period? No, but it was sort of, some of it was stored in my memory banks, right? So I revisited things like A Movable Feast. I, of course, reread Sylvia's memoir. But as you said, you know, my cast of characters are, Sylvia aside, actually, famous writers who left behind their own bodies, lifetime bodies of work. And they're so famous, other people have spent their lifetimes writing about them. So I just knew that I couldn't, I mean, I could have researched this book till the day I died, never written a word of my own. So, you know, there were a couple of ways that I was able to kind of be firm with myself. You know, one of the ways was I knew this was from Sylvia's point of view. So things by and about Sylvia really had to take precedence for me. And also I was interested really in telling a story that hadn't been told and from the perspective of the people who we haven't heard from before. And we don't need to talk very much about this, but you know, when Ulysses stands trial in 1921, it's not actually the book or James Joyce who stands trial for quote unquote obscene material. It's two women publishers in America, Jane Heap and Margaret Anderson, who are the editors of this avant-garde literary journal called the Literary Review, who are brought up on trial for publishing obscene material. And they are the ones who are found guilty. So again, like my research was necessary. That helped to limit my research too, right? Because what I really needed to do was research Jane Heap and Margaret Anderson, because they were important, lesser known parts of this story. Yeah. And so all of those things were helpful. But like I said, I also certainly, and there's some good, very good nonfiction about the trials of Ulysses that I've read that have come out just in the last few years. One of them is called The Most Dangerous Book by Kevin Birmingham. That was great. Mm-hmm. there's a biography of Sylvia Beach that's kind of the definitive biography of her. It was written in the 80s by Noel Riley Fitch. So, you know, there were a couple of kind of major works of nonfiction that I really devoted myself to digest. But then I kind of dipped in and out of a bunch of other sources just to make sure that I was getting reminding myself of what I already knew and learning enough of what I didn't know to proceed with some amount of confidence.
Yeah, no, it didn't hamper me at all.
I'm just thinking about if I were to write a book like this, one of the things I might do.
In your dreams, McIntyre.
Yeah, as part of my research, I would be telling the publisher I need a slightly bigger advance because I need to go to Paris.
Well, I did go to Paris.
Six months, maybe a year or two. Did you go to Paris?
I did, but only for a week. But I don't know if we would have enough time for me to tell the story, but briefly, I actually stayed in a place that I discovered on Airbnb. It was called James Joyce Flat. And when I saw it on Airbnb, like Airbnb sort of put it in my way. Like I was looking for a place to stay. I knew I wanted to stay kind of in the neighborhood where all these people lived and where the original shops were. So I thought, no, this can't be. But like the first photo in Airbnb were the two plaques, one of which was, you know, on the outside of the building that said James Joyce lived here while writing Ulysses. And the other plaque said that the flat itself belonged to this very famous French writer named Valerie Larbeau, who was a very good friend of Sylvia's. So long story short, no one really knows exactly which apartment in the building it was. Joyce borrowed the apartment from Larbeau one summer, the summer of 1921. Indeed, while he was frantically trying to finish Ulysses. And after some negotiations and me telling the owner what I was doing in Paris, he lowered his rate for me and I stayed there.
Excellent.
I know. It was set back from the main road and you would put out a code at the gate and walk up this lovely, narrow driveway that emptied into this beautiful leafy courtyard. And I just got to imagine Joyce sitting there on a bench, you know, thinking about and revising Ulysses and Sylvia and, you know, Valerie Larbeau drinking aperitifs there over the course of years. And wouldn't you know it, but like when I originally arrived in Paris, it was raining. But as soon as the skies cleared, I walked up one block and there was another one of those plaques that says this was where Ernest Hemingway first lived when he arrived in Paris. So I was really in it. and I just felt so lucky that I was able to do that in the summer of 2019 before the world shut down and everything. So
okay, yeah. I have 9 million things I want to ask. And David or James, okay. But one thing I want to ask about is the relationship between Sylvia Beach and James Joyce. And Sylvia clearly was possessed, obsessed with getting Ulysses published. And I think she, my words, not yours. So this is why what she was meant to be. And this is why Shakespeare and Company, the store was meant to be, is to get this book published that was being banned. Mm-hmm. But people were warning her about her partner, Adrienne, who had a huge influence on her life, was warning her, and others were warning her from the beginning, you need to separate the man from the work. And this is something we've talked about on the show before. David, we've talked about so many different artists. Can you separate the person and things they may have done in their life that you don't like, you don't admire, or you're negative towards, and their work? But what was the tipping point? I know, because I've read the book, but what was the tipping point, or what were the tipping points that caused Sylvia to realize she needed to separate her incredible passion for the work of the man from the man himself, and her willingness to forgive all sins?
Yeah, you know, that is such a complicated question. And I don't think that there's one real tipping point. There's, as with, I think, many things in a life, any life, it's a series of small moments that kind of have a cumulative effect, right? Yeah. And I won't get into too many of what those are, because I do think that that's part of the journey of the book. But one thing I will say that I don't think is a major spoiler is I actually think that part of her ability to ultimately let things go has to do with her incredible respect for his work. She really, her offer to publish Ulysses like the underpinning of that was that she believed in the book. She believed that the book was going to change people, change the world, change literature. And she was right. Yeah. But she just had this incredible belief in it. And when the opportunity later comes for American publishers to kind of push the book back through the legal system and unban it, she just wants what's best for the book in the end. Mm-hmm. And that is kind of a through line in her relationship with Joyce and in her ability to kind of, I think in one way, it seems like she's always conflating the work with the man, but I think in other ways, maybe she's always keeping them separate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's absolutely wonderful. Okay. One quasi serious question, and David, Jamie, if you have any, jump in. Food is a running thread through this book. Was that Sylvia? And she and Adrienne and their friends really enjoyed their flan, which is dreadful, by the way, and their wine, if that's, or is that Carrie injecting herself through the book?
Well, it's both. I mean, so I am a great food person. I love eating it. I at various times in my life, I enjoyed tackling hard recipes and things. I come from a foodie family, so it's definitely important to me. But it is also true that Adrienne was well known as a gourmet and a great cook. And so I just had to imagine that, of course, that would play a role in their lives. Sylvia was a chain smoker also, yeah, which I, you know, is in the book. She's very tiny. So I just sort of had to think about those kind of data points and think about like, okay, so what would Sylvia's relationship to all the bounty coming from Adrienne's kitchen be? I mean, I think she thoroughly enjoys French food and all the things. How can you write a book set in Paris and not go there with the cheese and the pastry and the macarons and all the jewel-toned fruits and the pâte de fruits and all the
and
things?
And not to give anything away, there's a great sex scene in this book which involves food. And she smokes a lot. And as the book goes on, she becomes more and more obsessed with the fact that she is smoking and her fingers are changing color. And I kept thinking to myself, okay, this is important. This must symbolize something else. I was like, no, she's just smoking. Okay, yeah. David, Jamie, I have a get out with this question for Carrie, but do you have anything for
us?
Yes, I actually do. So Tori, I have to say, I don't think we should go through the whole show without mentioning, you know, how incredibly timely this book is, because in some ways it's about the power of books and the banning of books. And we've just had this, you know, a really amazing thing that's happened with this graphic novel Mouse by Art Spiegelman being removed from the curriculum of eighth grade in Tennessee, which has caused everyone to go out
and
buy the book, including me.
Yeah. Number one on Amazon now.
And
really?
And it's there's just so many parallels between, you know, the romanticism and what was going on with the literary community in the 1920s in Paris, and what we're still experiencing today with people wanting to stop people from reading things. I feel like I want to have one section of my home library with I just want to fill it up with banned books.
That's a great idea.
It's a great idea. That's and put awesome. That on Instagram.
And that's right. That's an awesome gift idea. Here are the 10.
I'd be interested what Carrie thinks about that. But what's going on with that?
I think you said it exactly right. I mean, there it's sort of remarkable that, you know, here we are 100 years later, because we are tomorrow is the 100th anniversary of Sylvia's edition of Ulysses. February 2nd of 2022 is the 100th anniversary. It appeared in the store and in Joyce's hands on his 40th birthday. So it's really great.
Okay.
But, you know, like, so we take Ulysses totally for granted now. You know, all of those books that were thought to be, you know, so scary and, you know, threatening 100 years ago, we just take for granted. And yet here we are doing it again with another younger book, let's say. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I because I do write historical fiction, I tend to look at all of this through the lens of history. And I just wonder, like, what are people going to be saying 50 to 100 years from now about this Mouse thing? I mean, it's, you know, Mouse has been around for It's yeah. like 20 years old or something at this
At
point,
least 20
right?
years old. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, but so older. It'll be interesting what I think history has to say about this particular moment in censorship history. I don't know.
Yeah. But you know, Ulysses was obviously about, they said it was obscene. Mm-hmm. In this case, the Tennessee School Board involved said that this was inappropriate for that age group because right. of nudity and strong language. And then, of course, when I got my copy of the book, I discovered the nudity was, you know, unclothed cartoon mouse figures. you know, so not exactly.
By the way, hasn't Mickey been running around for 100 years without pants on?
That's correct. Many, well, it just is, put Minnie Mouse a new uniform.
But,
new
and yeah. the book is extremely powerful. And it's told in a way that's just, it's a very powerful graphic novel that frankly I was unaware of. So thank you, Tennessee, for bringing it to my attention.
Yes. There you go.
Well, it's also this question of like, who are we trying to protect? Right. And so in this right. case, it's the eighth graders, but in the case of Ulysses, it was women.
Yeah.
with the great irony being it was women publishing it. Anyway.
Right. My question is a little off the beaten path, but not too much. I just wonder what you think. Now, you have at this particular point historically in your novel, you have Hemingway and all of these James and all these people who all these great writers who are in Paris together at the same time. And in New York, you have the Algonquin Roundtable at the pretty much the same time with Dorothy Parker and all of those people. And then in Harlem, you have the Harlem Renaissance at the same time with Langston Hughes and Zora Neale Hurston and all those people. I just wonder, why do you think that all happened at the same time with the same group of writers, intellectuals, thinkers, poets, all kind of getting together? And
I think it was partly World War One. Right. Yeah. I think it was the absolute world and worldview shattering nature of that war that just absolutely dismantled for these people who were young living through the war. It just absolutely, first of all, it decimated almost most of a generation. Right. And then and it fundamentally changed relations between the sexes. Women had to go out. And, I mean, we think about Rosie the Riveter in World War II, but also women had to work during World War I too. So there was a real shift in gender relations. You know, the kind of like very conservative social, you know, mores of the, you know, the pre-war years were just like the young people who were out being flappers and drinking their bathtub gin, they were just like, what are you even talking about? you know? And so it was this weird moment where, on the one hand, there was this incredibly progressive spirit in Harlem, in all kinds of neighborhoods in New York, in Berlin, in Chicago, in Paris. But also there was this, you know, conservatism that people really were holding tight to the old ways, right? Like, mm-hmm. And you know, anti-immigrant sentiment was just mm-hmm. so strong. And so I don't know, like, I think great art often emerges from tension like that. And so those kinds of incredible tensions that were just true in those post-war years produced this incredible artistic moment.
Yeah. Dave, to your point, I was reading this book and not thinking big thoughts, but reading this book and thinking about these people who were hanging out together. These incredible people hung out together with Sylvia and Adrienne, and they hung out in the store together and they'd go out for a drink together. And I thought, wow. And I was explaining this to my husband, Brian. I was like, you know, who do we hang out with? We're like, sheesh, not Hemingway. Yeah. I mean, we're just kind of going through the list going, nope. We love our friends, but we're not exactly, you know, our thing is like, you know, was last weekend or this weekend the greatest weekend in football? So it's just not quite the same.
You know what though? You don't know. Like, so when Hemingway wandered into Sylvia Beach's store, he was just a cub journalist for the Toronto Star. Yeah. Like, he was nobody.
But what you're saying is that years from now, someone will write a historical fiction book called The Washington Podcaster, and it'll
That's
be about
correct.
Corey.
That is exactly right. That is exactly what I'm saying.
Intellectuals that she gathered around her.
Exactly. Okay.
Now, Shakespeare and Company is still in Paris, but it's not the same one?
Yeah. So very briefly, Sylvia did have to close her store in 1941 during the Nazi occupation of Paris, and she never reopened. The current Shakespeare and Company was opened in that location. If you've ever been there, you can sit and have a cup of tea in their cafe and look right at Notre Dame Cathedral. It's an amazing location. It opened in 1951 under the name Le Mistral, and it was an English language bookstore run by an American named George Whitman. And Sylvia was a regular at that store, in fact. But he rechristened it Shakespeare and Company in 1964 after Sylvia's death and also on the 400th anniversary of Shakespeare's birth. And that the current Shakespeare and Company, which has been named that since 64, has its own amazing history. And it is very much also a tribute to Sylvia's original store. I mean, there's all kinds of great books and pictures and information in the store about Sylvia's original. And George actually had a daughter who he named Sylvia, who runs the store today. So it is run by Sylvia Whitman, you know, and so it's a great, it's a wonderful, like the whole tradition of the, of Shakespeare and Company in Paris is a really beautiful one.
Yeah. One of the things I can highly recommend to everybody who goes out and buys The Paris Bookseller by Carrie Mayer from their favorite independent bookstore is read the author's note, wait, save it till the end. Don't jump to it, which I sometimes do because it's fabulous. And another time we have you back, Carrie, I want to ask you how you kept yourself from keeping the story going through Nazi occupation of Paris, because they're incredible pieces of that. But that is a great tease for people have to buy the book.
Yes.
They can read the author.
What's the name of the book again, Tori?
The Paris Bookseller.
Paris Bookseller.
You know,
I wanted to make sure I was the Paris Bookseller.
You know, in It's a Wonderful Life, that horrible treacly movie, every time, mommy, every time a, you know, a bell rings, an angel gets his wings.
Yes.
Every time you mention a book on a podcast, the author gets a sale.
Which book was that?
The Paris Bookseller.
The Paris Bookseller. I just want to make sure I had
that right.
Thank you,
guys.
Okay. A couple of pieces of housekeeping, then I swear to God we'll get out of here. We are back next week with Nick Petrie, who is the author of The Runaway. And I know I love to make fun of the New York Times Book Review because it's so freaking pretentious. But when they say something nice about an author, I have to quote them. And it says, Nick Petrie has a preternatural talent for ratcheting up suspense, even as he ensures readers continue to care not only about Ash, that's his hero, but about the people he's trying to save as well as the ones he must defend against. It's a great book. So we will have him next week. Claude, award-winning Claude, thank you for making everything happen, my friend.
No problem.
As ever. David, Jamie, great to see you, my friends. Carrie Mayer, thank you so much. The book again, The Paris Bookseller, everyone should get it. Don't jump to the end of the author's note. Read the whole book. You love it.
Thank you so much. I had a great time talking with you all. It was great. Thank you.
We loved having you. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and everybody stay healthy. We're out.
This is Chatter on Books. Use only as directed.